So, Paul, you are well known in the aviation community for making videos analyzing risk and benefit for different situations. So I got a call out here. I think you're speaking out of kind of both sides of your mouth. You're saying that you're going to go around because there isn't sufficient margin to land and stop safely, right? But at the same time, you're talking about these accidents in a high-powered airplane like a Cirrus, where in a sudden go-around, the pilot loses control and ends up in a smoking hole on the left side of the runway. This pilot is now having to suddenly do this go-around and doesn't have a lot of experience in the airplane and probably hasn't practiced that sudden go-around. But they have practiced lots of landings recently because they've just been checked out in it. Isn't the better risk equation to say, just land, worst possible thing that could happen is a low-speed run-up against this other airplane, and that's really unlikely, maybe a brake fire from stand on the brakes, whereas a go-around, if executed poorly, could be a stall spin and a fatal accident.
Follow my logic, young Jedi. The go-arounds that end up in accidents are the ones that are executed from low in the flare or early in the flare, or recovered attempts at recovered bad landings because the pilot botched the touchdown. He was either too fast or too slow, got the airplane crow hopping and goes around full power, all 310 horsepower. And all of these things have a characteristic endpoint, which is it ends up at the on the left side of the runway at the departure end, sometimes overturned, badly damaged, and often on fire. So what I said, it's better to go around sooner rather than later. So a go around executed from 100 feet or 200 feet is a lot different than one from 10 feet. And if you begin to go around at that altitude, you have a lot more margin. You have more altitude, you have more time to get the rudder in and hold the airplane on attitude and on speed. And if you get into a little bit of a departure, you can recover it. But at 5 feet, you're not going to do that. And that's what the accident pattern shows.
We're going to do Dave, then Wally.
But first, Obi-Wan there has got to explain to me why he goes to these great lengths to explain that there is sufficient margin, and then he's going around because there's not sufficient margin. So come on, Paul, which is it?
This is for me. An experienced Cirrus pilot could do this in a cakewalk. And the other day, during Sun and Fun, I flew that Cub Crafters NX Cub, that screwy little Cub with a ton of power and a nose wheel. And I fly Cubs all the time. That's practically all I fly. I'm flying this thing and I can't get it slowed up to get the landings I'm looking for. I'm trying to plant this thing and I can't get it slowed up. And the reason is I don't have enough time in it. So I'd have to go out in the airplane myself. I don't want an instructor observing me, and I'll figure the airplane out. And that might take an hour, it might take two, whatever it takes. So if I had done the same thing in a Cirrus, and I know I can be on speed, and I know I can plant the airplane where I want it in the right attitude, no question I would land. But that's not me. And I don't think that's necessarily this guy either.
Wally.
Well, I'm with Paul on the early go-around. This pilot took the Embark program, which means he got a significant and a well-organized course of training, which should have included a whole bunch of go-arounds. I think his odds of making a nice, safe go-around are a lot better than, as Paul said, getting distracted with the landing, getting in the crow hop scenario, and then trying to make something out of that mess. That's usually where they turn out really bad.
So I know, Kevin, you had said that you would land in this situation. Why?
Well, we just talked a bit about the training that this pilot had gone through. So this is a lot of recent training, recent experience. This is a proficient pilot. This is somebody that should be pretty good at landing the airplane. And in the setup, we said that he was on a stabilized approach, and I think we've got some sufficient margin for error on the landing here. I know there might be some discussion about the requirements of ATC and separation responsibility and that kind of thing, but I definitely want to come right out and say I want to put all that aside. The 7110.65 is a couple inches thick. There's a whole lot of stuff in there. And as a pilot flying where I'm looking at another airplane down the runway, I just don't care what that requirement is for ATC because whether it's legit or not. Maybe ATC screwed up. Don't tell anybody, but that happens sometimes. I don't care about that part of it. Another part that is a concern for me is when you're going to go around in a Cirrus, which is a low-wing airplane, you're potentially going to have a visibility problem with this airplane underneath you as you're going around. The other part of it is a Cirrus doesn't have a manual trim wheel. So you're busy using electric trim to nose it forward. You're being careful not to hit the aileron trim when you're doing that on the control on the Cirrus. And also, you have to clean up the airplane because you have landing flaps. And in the go-around, when you clean up the airplane, if you pull up the flaps too quickly, which is something that a low-time Cirrus pilot could presumably do, you're going to sink a bit. And that's just part of what you do on the climb out if you are a little bit too quick to retract those flaps. And it, certainly there's other airplanes that do that. But with 310 horses and cleaning it up and going around, there's a lot of trim you got to do. There's a lot of stuff you're doing in the cockpit. It would be really easy to lose sight of that Skyhawk underneath you that's been cleared for a stop and go. Now, the other side of that is that Skyhawk that's underneath you, they may or may not be aware that you're going around over the top of them. And when they start their go part of the touch and go, now you have a high wing airplane underneath and they may not know to look for you. And you may be in a spot where even if they did know, they might not be able to see you. So I could think that in a situation like this, you could easily wind up in a spot where you're flying formation with a totally different type of an airplane that you can't really see and could have a hard time avoiding on the climb up.
Pretty convincing argument there. Can I get anybody else to change their vote on going around based on Kevin's risk-benefit analysis here? Going once? Going twice? No. People are still going around. Dave, you're going around, but you said for a different reason. Why are you going around?
Yeah, you know, Kevin was saying he's not concerned at all about ATC or what the ramifications are. And I was just thinking that I am, you know, I'm concerned about the ramifications a little bit for me, but I'm actually more concerned about the controller. It's like, I'm just thinking that, hey, this controller has lost situational awareness. They've cleared two airplanes to land. They're both going to be on the runway at the same time. He explained about that that's okay. But it doesn't feel okay. It feels more like, hey, there's confusion here. And the best way is to avoid the confusion is to just try to reset. Murphy's Law being what it is, Kevin's absolutely right. The 172 is going to take off right about the time that you're going overhead. So it's like imperative that you keep the 172 in sight. So it's like it would be an early go around and a sidestep to keep the departing Cessna insight.
Let's hear from another controller here, Katrina. And I'm also curious if you could follow up on what Dave said. Would that be a problem from a controller's point of view? I'm curious about that as well.
I'm going to say Dave is stealing words out of my mouth here. My concern isn't necessarily the margin of safety when I chose number three. My concern was actually that this controller hasn't seen that person is still stopped and hasn't started moving yet. And they are going to send you around later in a maybe less positive situation, less planned. And I think that you should go around first. And my choice was going to say yes, offset. As long as your offset is away from the other runway that is where the traffic is landing and holding short of yours, in case they, for some reason, needed to go around because they didn't think they'd be able to do their lasso. I would choose, I believe in this case, a left turn for a slight offset. And it's very small. I mean, I would just move myself to the side of the runway so that I could look down and see that aircraft. If I planned that early, I should be above that high wing aircraft. And so I have some situational awareness. And yes, there might be some concerns about a go around being very busy, but again, this person has gone through the Cirrus training. There shouldn't be any reason that they are incapable of doing an efficient go around. Certainly still a little on the low side. So that's why I would recommend that go around early, but I don't see the offset as being a problem in any way. Paul, you mentioned the 3,000-foot requirement. The departing aircraft is actually supposed to be airborne as well as 3,000 feet down the runway. And then I was thinking, well, that requirement increases the likelihood that the controller is going to call a go around late, because it's not just 3,000 feet, it's also airborne. And I have seen plenty of controllers ask for the sort of panic go around, so to speak. And I think it's better to avoid that situation for this pilot.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, maybe it does. And this is going to maybe sound a bit of like a scofflaw sort of attitude here, but I noticed that it appears that Newport News does not have ASDE, from what I can tell, just looking here. Now, from the tower cab, looking out the window at a Skyhawk that's a mile away, it's depending on how good your vision is. Maybe you're looking out the window and, geez, they're rolling. Yeah, it looks to me like they're airborne. I'm pretty sure they are. Yeah, that, and I think from my best judgment, that looks like it's got to be at least 3,000 feet. I'm not going to say that it never happens like that. Controllers sometimes make mistakes. Sometimes controllers might drop a pencil they need to pick up, or any number of things. That kind of stuff is really the root of why I say that I'm not going to, as a pilot that's on short final, I'm not going to stress about what the requirements are of the tower controller. I'm going to worry about what's going to keep me safe.
Dean, then Paul.
We definitely have some risks in both options here, whether to go around or to go ahead and land. But to me, I just think the going around sooner rather than later is a good option here. And I'm not comfortable, generally speaking, even though there may not be a regulation, I'm not comfortable landing on a runway with an airplane some distance down the runway. And Jeff, I kind of feel like in the very beginning there, you sort of minimized the effect of running into another airplane, even at slow speed. Anytime a propeller chops into another airplane from the tail, that's not going to be a pretty situation, regardless of how fast they're going. And so I just don't want to take that risk. And here's another thing to think about. Let's say we land and we have gone past the last available taxiway, and we stop, say, 10 feet short of that 172. Then what? Do we turn around and back taxi back to the last available taxiway? It just puts me in a situation that I haven't faced before, and I would be scrambling to think about what to do. So I would rather go around early.
Paul?
Yeah, I was just sketching out here an analysis on that go around. So if the Cirrus starts to go around at, say, 150 or 200 feet off the approach end of the runway, there's no possible way that no matter what that 172 does, that he could hit it. He would be so far above it and within about a minute or less, well beyond it, because this 172 rolls so slow. So, I mean, I would do the sidestep to keep it in sight, just as a matter of good airmanship. But I don't see how you could possibly have a conflict there unless you really didn't get the climb going in the Cirrus. And then you'd really have to not get the climb going.
That's fair enough. To be clear, you are over the threshold at 70 feet, so you're a little bit lower than you said. But that's a good point. And
yeah, but I'm starting the go around sooner than that.
Ah, well, then you're changing the setup. This pilot didn't get to that point. They are at 70 feet when this decision. Yeah, they should have started it earlier. I agree, but at this point they waited, so you're at 70 feet. But I assume you're still going around.
Yes.
And for that sidestep now. Let's just to play devil's advocate here. If you're going left, you're now in the left seat. You're going to have to move pretty far left to not be looking through the passenger seat to try and see the runway down there.
Why am I going left? I would go right.
So you would go, Paul would go right towards the other runway on the offset.
Yeah.
So we got a little bit of a divergence on the offset. I got a question with Wally who wants to add in.
I have a question for Paul. Our pilot has been recently trained and probably has been practicing, so chances are he's pretty proficient. In those Cirrus go-around accidents that you've looked at, Paul, do you know, are they high-time pilots, lots of time in Cirruses, or are they new pilots in a Cirrus?
All of them, they're all over the map. Some are new pilots. I remember one of them, I'm being shocked, he was like a 10,000-hour ATP. fairly new to the airplane. And they all get in trouble almost for the same reason, that they botched the landing. And they would have been through some kind of training, many of them, either Embark or the Cirrus new owner factory training. And it's all great stuff. It's good training, but it doesn't make you bulletproof against anything. And I think if you want to survive in these airplanes and not bend them and break them, I think you got to build in as much margin as you can until you get really, really good with it. And maybe even more so then.
Well, I think there's also a great lesson for us instructors on the panel here that we need to be sure we're emphasizing go-arounds. They seem so simple that sometimes we tend to want to do tricky stuff. And we need to make sure that the pilots we're testing on flight reviews are really capable in the go-around area.
Now, with a bunch of flight instructors at the table here, I'm curious, did you regularly practice go-around stalls with your students as opposed to a power on stall? Difference being, you know, the classic power on stall, we usually have a clean configuration, high power, it's the takeoff stall. Yet a go around stall, especially if trying to prevent the kind of accident Paul says, and let's suppose this pilot started to continue to land, and as Katrina pointed out, there's the panic go around from the tower, go around now, and you are deep in the flare, right? That's a true go around stall, high power, full flaps. How do you do that safely? Is that something you've done in the past? And how would you suggest someone practice that? Because as Paul says, that's a real accident scenario. Dave.
You know, that's an excellent point. And I've got to confess, I do not practice that as an instructor. You know, it's not going to be on the check ride. So we don't typically practice that, but that would be an excellent thing to practice. And, you know, Paul has a good point, too. And that is that an SR-22, it's kind of a beast when you 310 horsepower. When you add that all at once and that prop governor shifts to high RPM, I mean, it's got a really strong left turning tendency and it needs a boot full of right rudder. So those are excellent points. And one other thing, a couple of people, I think Paul and Wally have both mentioned, you know, the distraction of having another airplane on the runway. And I do a lot of formation flying where we land with multiple other airplanes on the runway, but that distraction is real. It's not to be minimized. And I remember one time being part of there was a group of steermans that was landing at Reagan National Airport. There was some special event going on there. There's I think six steermans landing. All very experienced steerman pilots, but not experienced formation pilots. And one of them touched down. You know, I think he was number two or three in the group, but he knew there was an airplane in front of him somewhere. And that steerman in the landing flare goes blind. Without realizing it, he touched down with the brakes locked. And that airplane flipped right over on its back. And it was because of the distraction of knowing there was another airplane on the runway in front of them, even though in that scenario, just like this one, there was, enough distance.
Paul, then Dean.
You may recall, Dave, that that pilot had a Washington Post reporter in the front cockpit, which got a lot of interesting press play. One thing when I started instructing was a big deal, was something we called the trim tab stall. Do you remember this? This was a Cessna thing. And it was a scenario where the pilot was approaching with full flaps in a 172, and he was trimmed nose up because the 172 has a nose down moment with the flaps down, applies full power and the nose pitches up. So I practiced those a lot with students because I was instructing a lot of primary and 172s. And we did those. I did them in the heat of battle. I mean, I did them real go arounds, not from real low altitude, but starting the flare and then, okay, got to push the nose down while you're cranking like crazy on the trim. And it's a muscle memory thing you can teach. You can teach a pilot to respond to that. Now in the Cirrus, it's a different thing. And as Dave said, I mean, it's a huge amount of right rudder. And if you're not used to that, it's more right rudder than you can imagine. I mean, it's really, it does take that much when it's slow. So that stuff can be trained, but I think you have to not just train it, but also practice it and do it once in a while so you don't get caught unawares.
Dean and Katrina.
I learned a fun new phrase in this scenario, and that is moral turpitude. So, Paul, thank you for that. It reminds me that we need to continuously remind ourselves and be teaching our students that regardless of how we answer this particular scenario, that we need to keep in mind that a go-around is not a sign of weakness or moral turpitude, but it's actually sometimes a very wise decision. So that's a good thing to keep in mind.
Katrina.
I was just going to add, you asked the question about whether instructors teach a go-around from the flare. And I haven't really taught it on purpose, but a place where I have actually had students do it is oftentimes if they're having trouble learning what the flare should look like. And I'm sure all of you guys have done this. You'll have them add power and just hold it in the flare as they fly down the runway. And then they're in that go-around attitude and a flare, and somewhere in the vicinity of, you know, midpoint of the runway or a certain amount of runway remaining, you basically practice the go-around. So that's a place where it really makes a lot of sense to do that practice that works in really easily with some other training.
You know, reflecting back on this scenario here, I think kind of one of the core questions is, why is this landing any different than landing on a 5,000-foot runway? I mean, essentially, the available runway ends 5,000 feet down, not because it's grass, but because there's a Cessna parked there. And if this was a Cirrus pilot coming out of this program, landing on a 5,000-foot runway, aiming for the 1,000-foot marker on speed, 70 feet above the threshold at crossing, I don't think there's a single person at this table who would say that pilot should go around. Not a one. And yet, functionally, that's exactly what's happening here. This is a pilot crossing the threshold 70 feet in the air on a 5,000-foot runway, with the only real difference is that at the last, you know, brick, there's another airplane with people in it. But to me, I was with Kevin about the landing, but yeah, I'm now a little bit torn as to whether it's, yeah, go ahead and land, or that's enough of a distraction to make it worth actually not landing. So if there's a takeaway from all of this, I think it is what Paul started with, make that decision back early on, not 70 feet in the air over the threshold or further back when the controller, or further down rather, when the controller says go around and I'm in the flare and now I actually am in a potentially really hazardous situation. I'm going to make the decision that I don't like the way this is setting up further back up the chain, or I'm going to make the decision back there that I'm committing and landing on this runway, switching to my short field procedure or whatever it is, and that if it's a safety of flight thing, I am going to put down on this runway no matter what and stop because I am too distracted, and that's my authority there. And I'm sure some of the controllers at the table might take exception to my saying, I'm not going to go around because it's too late and it's not safe. But no, they're shaking their heads. So I appreciate that. They're behind that as pilot in command.